Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, did you know that the EU and the US are legally merging to shut out China and Russia's trade? Also, where did most of the limestone to build the houses in the south of England come from? We find out somewhere near Lyme Regis, believe it or not. We speak to John Scott from the Beer Quarry Caves. That is just, like I say, near Lyme Regis and Devon and the Dorset border. And we start this week by plunging down the caves of Beer Quarry Caves, which is where much of this limestone was dug out. And we hear that this quarry was very nearly blasted and locked up forever.
My name's John Scott, and for many years I've been involved with the preservation of the underground workings now known as Beer Quarry Caves. Over a period of almost 2,000 years, generations of local families, even young children, earned their livings here quarrying beer stone. Now, it's a type of limestone, but it can't be found anywhere else in the world. It's ideal for stonemasons carving very fine details, but in the outside world dries a creamy white colour and becomes up to five times harder.
Ah, because this is the trouble with limestone, is it can be quite crumbly, can't it? Not all that good for building a cathedral or something.
Yes, well, beer stone, the seam, was actually discovered by the Romans in the first century, buried here beneath 200 feet of solid rock, so it's impossible to reach by digging from the surface. But throughout the centuries that followed, generations of local families, even young children, earned their livings here deep below ground in appalling conditions.
Okay, how young? That sounds pretty horrifying.
Well, I grew up in Beer next door to an old lady who'd actually worked here when she was only 8 years old. 70 years after they passed the law to say no one under 14 must work underground. So they were still employing eight-year-old children. Now, when the Romans came, they made the entrance that we walked through just now. You can tell they were great architects because here they supported the roof with arches like a Roman building when they were quarrying beer stone to build their villas. Well, the quarry was then worked continuously until 1920. So today, you can see beer stone in Westminster Abbey, Tower of London, Hampton Court, Windsor Castle, in 24 cathedrals throughout the country. The sad thing is, when thousands of people like us visit those buildings, we can admire all the carvings done by stonemasons long ago. But how many ever stopped to wonder where the stone they used actually came from? So it all started, as I say, in the first century with the Romans making the entrance. But then, of course, the Saxons came here. And then the Normans quarrying beer stone created a huge industry, employing over 600 people below ground all those years ago. Well, for almost 700 years, the quarry was owned by the bishops of Exeter. Because they needed such a massive workforce here, the bishops employed quarrymen. Stonemasons, carters, wagon builders, wheelwrights, blacksmiths, harness makers. The incredible thing is accounts that were kept at the cathedral of that work have survived. So you can still find the names of people who worked here centuries ago. The wages they were paid, the cost of sharpening tools, delivering stone, even feeding the horses are recorded every week. So they tell an incredible story.
They certainly sound like they do, but what's the extent of the cave network then? It sounds like there's been quite a lot of quarrying going on here. They must have made quite a lot of tunnels.
Well, in actual fact, it's the largest underground workings in the south of England. And here below ground, without machinery, they left us with 75 acres of underground space, cut out of solid stone 20 feet high just by hand. But you've got to remember, the stone was transported from here hundreds of miles on horse-drawn wagons and barges as it's held from Beer Beach back then. The smallest blocks weighed 4 tonnes.
Now, I can remember from working in Salisbury that the restoration of the Salisbury Cathedral, they actually went back to Chilmark, which was where they got the original stone from. So is there still a demand for your quarried limestone here for restoring buildings that were built originally from it hundreds of years ago?
There is a huge demand still for beer stone for restoration. Now, the sad thing is, although this quarry stopped work in 1920, it never ran out of stone. It was so far to take horse-drawn wagons underground to the deepest working face at that time, they moved underground the opposite side of the road. Now, at the moment, that's going through a change of ownership, which means no beer stone is being quarried. But we've just had special permission to come down here and quarry some stone for the restoration of Exeter. But the records are so good, we can go to the exact place they got the original in 1326. So that's how good the records are.
OK. Okay, and also give us an idea of some of the maybe local buildings, because I would imagine some of the stone wasn't just used in these enormous, you know, church buildings, etc., that maybe some of the local cottages were built from them.
Yes, the thing is, there are only 7 buildings in the whole parish of Birr where you see good Birr stone. Most of them are made from an inferior type of limestone, discovered nearer the surface, and that's why those buildings are badly decayed in the weather. But because the qualities of Birr stone meant it was used for very high prestige buildings, that kept the price of it up far too much for a normal local person to afford to build a house out of it.
Now, there's also been a complete, I suppose, depression in mining generally. I mean, obviously, this is a quarry. It's not quite the same. And obviously, this place is no longer actually quarrying stone. So why is it that, you know, for centuries up until this present century or maybe the last century, these were very active places and the mines were too, and now everything seems to have slowed down? The tin mines I'm thinking of, for example, in Cornwall, even though it was supposed to be such a rich source of the metal, one of the richest on, didn't it even give Britain its name? I'm not sure about that fact, but anyway, how come these aren't so active as they've been in previous centuries?
A lot of the problem, I think, is importing stone from places like France and Italy. I think the classic example was some years ago when they restored the British Museum and used a certain French stone, which will remain nameless. And, I mean, anybody who looks at the front of the British Museum today and see that stone is badly decayed, realise they made a big mistake. Because you can see Birr stone in Roman villas, almost 2,000 years old, that's perfect. So we know it will survive that long. But it had to be put into a building the same way round as it was quarried, because there's a grain, like a piece of wood, as it was formed on the seabed. So down here, they'd always have a man called the tallyman. And he'd have a pot of red paint, a brush and a ruler, and when a wagon brought stone up from the working phase, he'd stop the horses, measure the size of the block, write a number on it in red saying how many cubic feet it is. That works out a coinman's wages and what the stone can be sold for. But because the stone's got this grain like a piece of wood, the tallyman would simply draw a vertical arrow in red, telling the mason this way up in the building. So providing it was laid in the building in the same plane it was quarried, we know the stone will survive for 2,000 years.
Now, I bet you look at some of our modern buildings and you think, gosh, if only they were being built out of some decent stone. Because I look at some of them, you know, a lot of them are just simply breeze blocks with a little bit of stone facing on them.
Well, yeah, stone has become a skin over the years because of the cost. But I think the classic example of what you're saying is that if you think of our ancestors using Birr stone in Westminster Abbey, the Tower of London and St Paul's Cathedral, now those three buildings have already stood for a total between them of more than 2,000 years. But the classic is about 20 years ago, a team of experts confidently said that a building designed by computer, built with the aid of machinery and using the finest modern materials, would attract more visitors than any other historic building in the country. Of course, within 12 months of its completion, it was thanks to a lack of visitors, what we knew at the time as the Millennium Dome was forced to close its doors to the public. So it was horses for courses, and every cathedral is a mixture of different types of stone. But you never find a cathedral built of one particular type. But like I say, you'll find Birr stone today in 24 cathedrals. But because of the price and imports over the years, that the competition has meant that stone literally has become a skin. They build with breeze blocks or whatever and just a facing. This section of the quarry is square, was done by the Saxons. If you go to the Norman part, when they took over, all the pillars are upright with capitals at the top, just like a Norman building. So underground, you've got the changing styles of architecture throughout the centuries. There is no one survey map shows the true size of the quarry. And that's because throughout the years, quarry owners having to pay a tax on the amount of Birr stone they sold produced maps to show the quarry smaller than it was, and Dodd's a tax man. So there's nothing new. Well, actually now we're in the Norman section, and they quarried stone here for 24 cathedrals we can see today, but when you realise that was thousands of tons, Back then, the Normans didn't have handsaws to work with. Here, they cut out almost 20 acres of space, and yet every mark we see now was a single blow of a Norman pickaxe back then. Do you know, they even discovered all those years ago if a crack should appear in the roof. They get one of the children to climb.
Like that one.
Yep, like that one above our head. They get one of the children to climb up and force a ball of red clay into it. And the Normans had worked out here where the temperature never changes, the clay wouldn't shrink. And the only reason for it to fall out would tell them the crack was opening and becoming dangerous. And of course, all engineers do now is glue telltale strips of glass over cracks instead. And you also find that the Normans got children to take the clay outside, mould it the shape of a pudding basin and bake it hard in the sun. So when they stuck a tallow candle on the rim, that's how the Normans made the very first safety helmets with lights on the front as well. We just don't give them credit for how clever they were. For years, I'd been interested in the quarry, even when I was a kid. I used to take people around here out of interest's sake. And then, knowing that there's 2,000 years of history down here, and we're still finding things to this day, some years ago, it was saved from the quarry company by 2 hours because they were about to blast the whole place flat. So that would have meant losing 2,000 years of our heritage.
Well, that's right. And also, of course, you were mentioning earlier that there's actually quite a lot of memories, community memories in the surrounding area, Beer Village, and the town, of what happened here. So that would start to die as well if there's not some kind of attraction or some kind. So, how did that happen? 2 hours from blowing up the entrance and really maybe burying it forever.
Well, it was very fortunate that some weeks earlier I'd taken Lord Clinton of Clinton Devon Estates, the local landowner, around the quarry. He owned the place, of course, didn't really know the history entailed. And he agreed with me at the time the place would never be lost. Well, of course, a few weeks later we hear the quarry company were going to blast it. So, thanks to Lord Clinton's help, we were able to obtain a lease on the place, stop that happening, and since then we've managed to keep it open to the public.
What about those that you've spoken to in the local area? What memories are there of this place? You mentioned one, but that can't be the only one.
In some ways, jealousy still exists in Beer between descendants of quarrymen and stonemasons.
So what's the difference?
Well, the stonemasons did all the carving of the blocks that the quarrymen worked, or produced. But the thing is, they couldn't transport beer stone to a cathedral in winter, because it comes from underground saturated with water. If you took it on a long winter's journey, it would be cracked by frost on the way, useless for carving. So every winter, the stonemasons travelled here from all over England. They can carve the stone per cathedral underground here, because the temperature never changes. But they caused jealousy in the village, in some ways still exists. You see, back then the stonemasons came into Beer Village, a small community. They're skilled men, they're highly paid. But learning all their trade secrets from their father or paying for an apprenticeship that would cost one of us a whole year's wages meant no one from the village could ever become a highly paid mason. Well, of course, once they'd finished their apprenticeship, every stonemason had to swear an oath he'd never reveal his trade secrets, and then he was free to move around from job to job, and hence we've got the Freemasons.
So what is the link between the modern Freemasons? Because, very few of those, if any, or maybe one or two, are actually really stonemasons nowadays.
No, somebody from any trade now can become a Freemason, if they're accepted into the guild, obviously. Of course, back then, the Freemasons knew the secrets of geometry, way back in the 11th century and things like this. They could work out how far the pillars had to be apart to take the thrust of a roof and things like this. So this has led to some of the modern-day symbolism of the modern-day Freemasonry. But the strange thing is, one of the secrets Freemasons kept for centuries was a gadget called a Lewis. It was dovetail in shape, made up of three pieces of iron, held together with a bolt. Well, to lift a 4-ton block of beer stone, you cut a hole in the top the same size and shape as the Lewis, which of course is wider at the bottom than it is at the top. Well, the Lewis wouldn't go in, but the secret was to remove the bolt. But when the Lewis falls in three pieces, you take a straight one out the middle, stick it on one side, drop the two tapered pieces of it into the narrow neck of the hole. And when they reach the bottom where the hole was wider, they come apart. So sliding the straight one down between and putting the bolt back, the bottom of the Lewis now too wide to pull back out the top of the hole. And that's how they lifted the blocks. Well, they were used by the Romans building Hadrian's Wall and still used today. And because the Lewis took the weight of stone for Freemasons throughout all that time is why Now, a Freemason's son is known as a Lewis, but supposed to take the weight off his father instead. In fact, anyone in this country with the surname of Lewis will probably find they're descended from a Freemason, knowing long ago if he revealed any secrets, he'd have been so severely punished that he'd never work again. Because it was by keeping their secrets, the Masons could always demand the highest wages.
Well, it'd be nice for people today if they were able to get those wages too. And you can see why there might be the jealousies, especially with the secrecy, the exclusivity. Does this have any lessons for us today, do you think?
Well, today, of course, the jealousy has become almost good-natured. It becomes banter now. But there is another jealousy that lives on in Beer Village because it's still a small community. And it came from the days when quarry was used for hiding contraband. The whole village was involved with smuggling, you see. It was the ideal place. No customs man would search down here. He knows he could get lost in all these tunnels or he'd get bumped off in the dark and nobody find out. That's why we're still finding things left by the smugglers.
What have you found that's been left by smugglers centuries ago?
We've dug out remains of French brandy barrels. Everybody knows they smuggled brandy. One day we were puzzled digging out two French soap boxes. But an expert explained there was a time there was so much tax just on good soap for the lady and the man, and members of the prison sentence smuggling that ashore to sell it and get money for the family. One day we took a lad of 14 to a park the public never see. Showed him where his family wrote their names, quarrying beer stone 250 years ago. Of course he was thrilled to bits. He turned round, tripped over. It was just an old bundle of oilskin. And we very nearly booted it in the corner. Luckily, when we sent it to the museum, they unwrapped the oilskin that had laid down here over 200 years, and in this atmosphere, beautiful pieces of silks have actually survived all that time. So there's stacks of evidence they were using the place to hide contraband. But when I said there's still jealousy in beer, not only between the descendants of Corman and stonemasons, but it comes from the days when everybody in the village hated the customs men. But what it means for me after all this time is I can walk in a local pub crowded with visitors, but within minutes I'll have the fishermen telling them that years ago their ancestors were smugglers, and one of mine was the local blasted customs officer, so they're still reminding me to this very day. We're open every day to the public from the Monday before Easter Monday till the end of October. There's guided tours every single day throughout that period. Website is www.beerquarrycaves.co.uk, and we hope over the years we can increase the number of visitors, because without the visitors, it's strange to think that this place supplied stone for so many historic buildings, and about 90% of our historic buildings have to depend on the number of visitors they receive to provide the funds for future preservation. And, of course, the quarry that provided that stone is exactly the same. Without the visitors, the whole place would be lost. But when you think down here now, we're still digging out tools that we used centuries ago. A horseshoe, which we've been told is one of the oldest ever found in England, dating from the early 11th century. Just inside the entrance, we've unearthed 41 1st to 4th century Roman coins. It's quite a thrill when you pick up something no one else has touched for all that time. And then just before we opened at Easter this year, we were having torrential rain running in the slope where we came in the Roman entrance. Well, it doesn't matter. The place is self-draining and it can't flood. But I told my grandson, he's only 14, to get a pickaxe and drag a little groove across the chalk floor to divert the water. 2 minutes later, he had a 3.5-inch long bronze Roman bow brooch to hold a cloak together. And the incredible thing is the spring still works after all this time. So when you think there's chambers down here where no one set foot for hundreds of years, hidden by waste, how much more history is there to find?
And also they do a very good cup of tea and a nice piece of cake up at the cafe after.
But the funny thing is, we very often get people right on the sites, for visiting places. I won't mention the name of the site, obviously, but we very often say, and after the tour, make sure you have a cream tea. It's the best in the area. So my daughter's quite proud of that.
And that was John Scott from Beer Quarry Caves down near Lyme Regis. And you might manage to get and see him because, as he's saying there, the caves close for the winter at the end of October.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Did you know the EU and the US are merging corporate trade law legally, or at least trying to, and that will be shutting out China and Russia in trade? It's called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, but that's a bit of a mouthful, so it's been shortened by the campaigners around it to TTIP, and it looks like it could be brought in at the end of this year. And I'm joined on the line now by Linda Corsher from Stop TTIP. Hi, Linda, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi.
Can you just tell us whereabouts has this come from, this TTIP, and what is it?
Well, the EU negotiates trade agreements on our behalf, and it's very, this trade agreement, like all the EU's trade agreements, very much driven by transnational corporations, and particularly financial service corporations.
Okay, so how, I mean, we like to think of the EU, at least, of being quite democratic with a European Parliament, MEPs and that kind of thing. So have they drawn this up, or is somebody else drawn it up, this agreement?
Well, the agreement's being negotiated. This is the process that the negotiations go on for as long as they take, really. It's certainly been an idea to bring together the market of the EU and the US for quite a long time. It took a bit of a dip when the liberalisation of financial services caused the global financial crisis, but it's been spun now into the answer to economic recovery.
Well, of course, I mean, if trade is made easier between the EU and the US, you would have thought actually that actually the economy might take off.
Yeah, but this is not about trade. But it's handy to call it trade because the general picture is that if it's trade, it must be good.
Hang on, because it says actually trade in the title, doesn't it? Transatlantic
sure,
trade.
It's called a trade agreement for that reason, because it carries that sort of vibe that it's trade, it must be good. But the focus, in discussing this, the focus is always on the fact that tariffs will come down and that will make consumer prices cheaper. But in actual fact, the tariffs between the EU and the US are already very low, so there's not a lot in it for tariffs. But this is really about, it's a corporate rights charter. This actually gives rights to corporations and correspondingly reduces the rights, the ability of governments to control corporations.
Okay, but let's try and get to the origins of it. So has it actually been drawn up by MEPs, by a European Commission? Who's actually drawn this up? Because it's probably going to be in their interests, I'd imagine.
The EU is three structures. The European Parliament that we vote for, the Council is made up of the member state representatives of the member state governments, and then the Commission, which is unelected bureaucracy and very much driven by the tremendous corporate lobbying in Brussels. So for an agreement like this, the Commission writes its own mandate, gets it past the Council and the European Parliament, and then goes ahead and secretly negotiates for, as long as it takes to negotiate the agreement. And then finally, when that's completed, it comes back before the European Parliament, which only has the power of assent. They can only say yes or no at that point, no amendments. And because this agreement will be what's called a mixed agreement there, that means that the member state parliaments have a bit of say in it as well. It will also come back to member state parliaments after it's gone through the European Parliament. If they say yes to it, then it will come back to member state parliaments for ratification. But don't sort of wait for that one with the UK, because it will just come back to the UK as secondary legislation, as a rubber stamping exercise.
I've heard that it's supposed to be all signed and sealed by the end of this year. Is that right?
That was their original intention. It was launched in the summer of last year, the summer of 2013, and it was supposed to be done on one tank of gas, it was said. Basically, get it through quickly before anyone realises what it involves, before people realise what's happening. But it's not going that fast. And as I say, a trade agreement takes as long as it takes, and one thing that gets in the way is elections, because nobody wants to talk about trade agreements, strangely, when there are any elections around. So There's been there have been six rounds of negotiations, which doesn't mean anything really. It tells you there's been six rounds, but you don't know how many there will be. So, towards the end of this year, there are midterm elections in the US, so that will put a break on it there. And then negotiations at the start of next year for a while. But then towards the end of next year, the US will be heading into their long process of presidential elections in the run-up to that. So that's something else that would be in the way of negotiations continuing. So it could or couldn't be signed up in, say, the first half of next year.
Okay, I know. I know.
Sort of timeline.
One of the sorts of organisations in Britain that's been campaigning on this is the trade unions. Why are the trade unions interested?
Well, there are big implications for jobs, loss of jobs. Trade unions are also concerned about public services, and particularly concerned, and there's very wide concern about the provision in this agreement for corporations to be able to sue governments for any regulatory change that negatively affects their future profits.
But can't they already do that? Corporations can sue the government if they want to?
No, not really, no. This provision exists in trade agreements in other parts of the world, so we can see the effects that it has. So it's like some examples are the Australian government being sued for its public health legislation with plain packaging for cigarettes, being sued by Philip Morris. The German government is being sued by a Swedish nuclear power company called Vattenfall for phasing out nuclear power. And the Egyptian government has been sued by Veolia, the water supply company, for increasing its minimum wage. So you can see that it can lead to big payouts. It can lead to a chilling effect on government's legislative process as they become afraid to legislate, really, on the stuff that we need them to legislate on the environmental stuff, on the labour rights, on public health.
Yeah,
because these are the very things that will negatively affect transnational corporations' future profits.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of big corporations are looking at the British healthcare industry and saying, well, actually, as the NHS is opened up to competition and privatised, there are a lot of big private healthcare companies looking at that as a way of making money. So would TTIP, if it's signed, affect what happens to the National Health Service?
The NHS. Yeah, in fact, the widespread concern about the NHS has really served to raise the issue of a trade agreement, because this TTIP, because trade agreements are usually pretty obscure stuff that no one's interested in, but people have found find it not difficult to understand that we're stuck with the Health and Social Care Act and all the disasters that's taken us into. But the difference that TTIP will make is that the act becomes irreversible. It's not hard to understand why that's a disastrous thing for us.
Well, I mean, it means Labour Party policy is null and void, doesn't it? Because they're supposed to be, well, they're saying that if they win the next general election in 2015, that they will actually repeal the act.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's right, null and void, yeah.
I find it a bit strange that any company or whatever could sue a government just for passing a law, because actually that's what governments are there to do, surely on our behalf.
Yes, it's and it's only transnational companies that can do it, like cross border. So it's discriminatory in that way that a domestic company couldn't do it. But also these cases are heard before an arbitration panel of three trade lawyers. So right outside of our legal systems, and over the top of our legal systems, really. So three trade lawyers who might be the arbitrators on that case, and then another time they will be acting for corporations in other cases, or they might be acting for the governments in other cases. It's a very small group of lawyers passing this work around, and obviously it's in their interest to keep it all going, and it's very highly paid work, yeah. But it means that it's a quasi-legal system outside of, and in fact above, our established national legal systems.
So are governments empowered to actually make agreements that make kind of null and void our own legal system? It just sounds a little bit like pie in the sky. I don't know if they'll be able to get away with it, Linda.
Well, it's in the mandate. It's in the Commission's mandate. And in fact, this aspect is called Investor State Dispute Settlement. So it's ISDS for short. So this is the provision for corporations to sue governments. The concern about it was so high that the Commission ran a 3-month consultation on this. It closed in mid-July. And more responses were received from this than from anything else previously. So 150,000 responses. And 50,000 of those, one-third of those, came from the UK.
Oh, well, it's nice to know that. The thing is, with these trade agreements, as you said before, Linda, it's seen by many people, probably the majority of us, as something which is way above our heads and is probably never going to affect us at all. Can you just give us an idea of how it might actually affect and impact our lives if this is signed?
Right. So a main part of this trade agreement is this suing the public purse in this. So the legislators will be inclined not to legislate. But a really major part of this trade agreement is harmonising the regulations between the EU and the US. That harmonising, supposedly for efficiencies, will actually be a deregulation. It will be a lowering of regulations to suit corporations.
So this is kind of going to the lowest common denominator. I mean, this happens, you know, in so many areas of our lives now in this, you know, increasingly globalised world. But what evidence have you got that it will, if you want, round down to the lowest rather than up to the highest? In other words, so that the regulations in the United States might have to be increased and tightened to bring it up to the standards of the EU?
Well, it's a corporate-driven agenda. The drivers are not there to bring regulation up. Everything's about taking it down. I'll give you an example with chemicals, and I mean chemicals run through everything, food and cosmetics. The US bans about 8 chemicals, and we ban 1,300. So we really have a lot to lose in this. And then you look at the food people eat. In the US, like 70% of their supermarket food is genetically modified, whereas very, very little of our actual food is, although it is in some animal feed. Those companies are pretty determined that they're going to get GM into the EU. So we have a lot to lose in harmonising of regulation.
It sounds like the implications, Linda, of TTIP are absolutely colossal, enormous.
It goes across everything.
So why has there been so little about this in the London media?
Certainly the government doesn't want it talked about. In fact, none of the major parties want it talked about.
Why is that? I mean, you'd have thought that this is something that they could even win them votes, maybe.
Well, it will only be an election. Presently, all the major parties support it.
Really?
Yes, really.
They support deregulation, all the major parties in Britain.
Support TTIP, yeah.
Amazing, okay. Well, that may be one
reason. So it will only become an election issue if we make it an election issue.
And is there any prospect of that, do you think?
That's up to us to do it. I mean, none of this stuff is like a preset path. It's trade agreements have been defeated before, and usually a major factor is it light, shining light on them, because when people know about them, they tend to think they're a bad deal. So spreading information, what we're doing now, in fact, is a really important part of it.
So tell us a bit about Stop TTIP. How do you operate, and are there ways that people can actually campaign on this issue if they want to, even just online or writing letters to MPs?
We certainly need to raise it with MPs who it's easier for them to ignore it because they don't have much of a role in stuff that's done by the EU. But so once again, there's really a role for people to raise it with their MPs.
So is it make sense to actually even contact MEPs for a change? Because I don't think many people actually ever talk to their MEP, do they?
No, there's the democratic deficit, isn't it? Most people don't even know who they are. And certainly don't know how they vote. Yes, people getting in touch with it, because it will be the MEPs who will vote yes or no on this at some stage.
So tell us, what's Stop TTIP been doing?
We've put on public meetings highlighting different areas that will be affected. So we've had public meetings on NHS TTIP and food TTIP, and environment and fracking TTIP, and we're going a bit further on October the 25th. We're putting on a meeting digging into the how the City of London dominates policy making in this country and beyond.
Okay, well, I didn't know that. I thought that the policy was made by political parties, by the government, and also over in the EU and Brussels by the European Commission. So what role does the city play?
Financial services are a really big push here. For instance, the City UK, which is the front group for the city, the transnational financial services that are the City of London, have had a committee for years called the Liberalisation of Trade in Services Committee. And so that's the top guys from the top banks and other financial institutions actually giving the trade bureaucrats who take UK policy, trade policy into the EU, our input into the EU. So they just give them their orders. So that bypasses the Parliament.
Well, that's a bit annoying, isn't it? Because, of course, these banks have been given loads of cash. I think
it's 700... the same old banks. That's right, the same old banks.
Well, the 750 billion or something they were bailed out in 2008, and they've been using that cash to lobby for even more deregulation. What else has Stop TTIP been doing?
Well, I've been going around speaking. Had a lot of meetings. Wherever people want to put meetings on, we're happy to go and speak to inform people about this.
So who's it,
this information side is a really key part of it.
So who's it been interested, apart from the unions?
Oh, there's very broad interest now. Certainly when on the big demonstrations that I've been to recently, I mean, we've been handing out leaflets, but I've found the awareness is already there with people. So the big demonstrations on the climate change and the Jarrow March, for instance, in London, it was really heartening to realise how many people had some degree of grasp about TTIP already and want to know more. So people are recognising that it's a big deal and not finding it inaccessible. They realise they can grasp it and understand what it is, because the bottom line is not that complicated. It's a corporate takeover.
Our votes, if this goes through, are going to mean almost nothing, because anything that politicians try to do, they're going to find impossible financially, because they're going to be sued by big corporations.
Yeah, and you can see the sort of governments we get would be quite happy with that, really, to have that limitation on what they can do, yeah.
Ultimately, it sounds like a bit of a battle between a democratically elected system, you know, parliaments and democracies and big corporations. Who's going to win, ultimately?
That depends on us. It depends if we let them win. It's not pre-laid out path. It's how much we fight it.
And what kind of world do you think we'll get if this does go through? Because it seems to me that if you've got a legal jurisdiction which spreads right across the EU and the US, then that's a large part of the world's trade is controlled by a few corporations in those regions of the world.
Yeah, there's also a Trans-Pacific Partnership being negotiated of 12 countries around the Pacific. The US is in both. So because it's self-secret, we don't see what's in it, but there are enough leaks to see what's in it and to see that that's heading in the same direction. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is the same sort of stuff as is in the TTIP, the transatlantic one. So it's bigger than if both these agreements go through. The idea is that the corporations are not getting what they wanted from the WTO, the World Trade Organization, because within the structure of that, developing countries were able to team up and resist the corporate-driven agenda of Western countries. So the Doha round ground to a halt, and we shifted to these bilateral trade agreements. Now we're into the really big bilateral trade agreement, the two biggest economies, the EU and the US, and the Pacific ones going on at the same time. So if that were all to go through, they would set that through those agreements, global rules would be set, and the other countries drawn in separately and unable to team up to resist that agenda. So it would be imposing, this is a stated aim for TTIP, is to establish global rules in this way.
It sounds like almost like these big corporations making the laws for the whole world. But anyway, how have these rounds of talks, you talked about, was it 6 or 8 rounds of talks, how have they been going? What do we know about what's been agreed so far?
Things are not agreed yet. I mean, apart from the growing public resistance, there are a lot of differences within the negotiations as well. So some parts are kind of more advanced than others, and some parts are held up.
I mean, can we use things like freedom of information laws to find out exactly what's being planned? Because one of the problems is that with many of these big corporate trade agreements is it can be sometimes quite difficult to find out what's being agreed in our name as the talks progress.
Oh, it is secret. It is secret. No, there is no freedom of information. It is secret. That was one key thing in the shift from the WTO, where you had these big global protests. The shift is not just from multilateral, like all the countries, shifting to bilateral, two countries. Another part of that shift was it all became much more secret. And the negotiations and the texts that they're using are secret until it's completed, even though it's being negotiated on our behalf. And it's secret from our members of parliament, our representatives there, and it's secret from the MEPs as well.
So who's actually making these negotiations, doing these negotiations on our behalf then?
The bureaucrats of the Trade Commission part of the whole commission. So, you know, like I said, it's in three parts, the Parliament, the Council, which is the representatives of governments, and then the unelected bureaucrats of the Commission. The Commission is in, I think, about 28 sections so that everybody gets to, or every country gets to have a commissioner. But the heavyweight commission within that is the Trade Commission, and that's who does the negotiating on our behalf.
It doesn't sound like there's a lot of chance that these people are going to be acting for ordinary people across the EU. It sounds much more like they're just going to be doing exactly what big corporations want, and they haven't really got a very good track record of looking after public interest.
No, quite the opposite. Quite the opposite, yeah.
Have you learned anything in previous campaigns to do with trade that has, you think, maybe helped in campaigning this time, has taught you about the way that these big trade negotiations operate?
Yeah, it's good having the background. One thing I think it helps me see through the spin, because the spin on this, as I said, is like this trade agreement is the way for economic recovery from the financial crisis. But when you've been looking at this stuff for quite a few years, you see that in after 9/11, it was actually the answer. The Doha round was the answer to global terrorism, and another time, the trade agreements were the answer to climate change. So you can really sort of see the spin coming through.
Now, one of the effects has been, obviously, through your campaigning and Stop TTIP's campaigning, that the Labour Party is saying that it will defend the NHS from the EU-US trade deal. That happened earlier this year. Do you think that was a bit of a victory, and do you think they really mean it?
I think it's a victory that they're being forced to talk about it, but there's a lot of bluff going on. What we need is an exemption. No two ways about it. We need an exemption of the NHS from the trade agreement, or better still, an exemption of health, because an exemption of the NHS would still be vulnerable, unlike alcohol legislation or cigarette legislation or something with the suing mechanism, right? But with the Labour Party, you're hearing it from who? Andy Burnham, who is currently the shadow health person, but might not be if they were got into government. He could be moved quite easily. And you're hearing it from John Healey, who actually chairs the all-party parliamentary group in the parliament, which is backed by big business and promotes TTIP. So not a lot of credibility there. Who you're not hearing it from is Miliband, to have a chance of pushing Cameron towards seeking an exemption from the NHS. We'd need Miliband on the floor of the House calling for this. You're not hearing it from Miliband. So that would have two effects. It would raise it to the level of the opposition totally supporting an exemption and calling on the government to do that. But it would also put a public focus on it and force journalists even to pay some attention to it. And spread public awareness at the same time. So that's what we need for an exemption. But we're not getting that. We're just getting one or two people in the Labour Party calling for that, and one of them's pretty dodgy. At least one of them's pretty dodgy anyway.
I noticed just this week that the European Union's Trade Commissioner elect, that's because they're just about to bring in a new commission, Malmstrom, has been clarifying that public services are in some ways going to be exempt from the trade negotiations. So do you think that's another little victory there?
No. No, I think it's all bluff. I mean, you're dealing with a very complex legal situation of our Health and Social Care Act and how that opens up to private contracting. You're dealing with EU competition law laid over the top of that, and then you're dealing with a trade agreement over the top of that. So there's a lot of legal complexity there, and there's a lot of room for them to dance around and pretend that this is safe, this is protected. But if it was true, they would just say it's exempt. We need the exemption. And all the rest, I think, is just bluff.
Well, the woman's name is Cecilia Malmstrom. She's going to be the new Commissioner for Trade for the EU. What they're saying is that she dealt quite impressively with a deluge of questions about this free trade agreement at her European Parliament hearing on 29th of September, acknowledging widespread scepticism but voicing hope that a resolution could be found. So there does seem some hope, even though you're saying actually you think that this is really kind of spin.
It was a very slick performance, and she made her way around the questions in a very slick manner.
Well, it's interesting,
then,
isn't
and
it?
And then she was voted in, yeah. But then you've got to consider where most European, you've got to consider where most MEPs are at. The biggest grouping is the party that our Tories belong to. Another grouping is one that our Lib Dems belong to. Another grouping is the one that our Labour Party belongs to. I mean, that grouping's got doubts about ISDS and that, but I mean, the Labour Party is essentially supporting TTIP, so there's no point in having the impression or the idea that all the MEPs are like really good guys, really there for us or anything like that.
So
only if we make them.
Yeah, Cecilia Malmström, I mean, call me a cynic if you want, but it sounds to me as if part of her test as to whether she's going to become the new European Trade Commissioner, and it now seems that she is whether she can spin, you know, the TTIP as something wonderful and wonderful. And it almost seems to me like these people aren't really our representatives on the Commission, that they're kind of almost PR people for the big corporations.
They're supposed to work for us. They're not representatives in the sense of being elected. They're bureaucrats. They are supposed to work for us, but the context of Brussels is very much suits and business. Yeah.
Also, China and Russia, we haven't mentioned them yet, because if this agreement is sealed between the Pacific people you were talking about, the EU, the US, where does the Chinese and the Russians stand in all this? Because it could end up with a sort of the world almost divided in half with a sort of giant trade war. Are they included in this, the Chinese and the Russians?
No, the Pacific Partnership particularly excludes China, that's right, yeah.
Interesting. Anyway, we'll see how this all plays out.
I think for Russia, the big deal at the moment is the deep and comprehensive free trade agreement that was the cause of everything that's happened in Ukraine and got signed up about a month ago.
Can you just explain that? I mean, I didn't realise this was related to Ukraine.
Yeah, there's been a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement, that's their words, not my description, lined up for a few years with Ukraine and also five other countries in the region. Three of them have dropped right out of that now. So it's Ukraine, Georgia and Moldova that are still either signed up or heading towards that. And it was when the president pulled out of it at the last minute in February.
That's Yanukovych, the previous president, who was more pro-Russian.
Yes, and that's when the effectively the civil war kicked off, and then top EU people were there trying to keep the Ukraine on side, and then they elected this chonky government and finally got their agreement signed up. And he resigned, that president resigned straight after, but they got their agreement signed. So that's been signed up now. I was in a meeting about 3 years ago in Warsaw actually, where it was admitted by the Trade Commission that there is no appetite for further expansion of the EU for more accessions, right, especially of low socioeconomic countries. So having deep and comprehensive free trade agreements is a substitute for accessions, and it's on a promise of that you join the EU eventually. So if you do it as a comprehensive free, as a trade agreement instead of an accession gets discussed amongst the whole EU, but a trade agreement is only dealt with by the secretive Trade Commission.
Interesting, a kind of Trojan horse. Anyway, Linda, finally, where is a good place to follow developments with this TTIP?
StopTTIP.net website. We've got an email list that people can join for information.
That was Linda Corsha from the Stop TTIP campaign, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. That sounds absolutely massive, even though we've heard very, very little about it. Means big corporations could be taking over not just here in the EU, but in the US and in the Pacific too. Absolutely amazing. So let's have a little bit more coverage, I think, from other parts of the press, please. And her website is stoptTIP.net. That's stoptTIP.net. And you can get hold of a leaflet for the princely sum of £1.50, all about TTIP, bang up to date as well. stoptTIP.net. Thanks very much to Linda Corsha. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, John Scott from Beer Quarry Caves down there near Lyme Regis, and also Linda Corsha from Stop TTIP. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute if you'd like to. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org dialect.co.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now. You want me?